Welcome to Journalism Now, number 23. We're back from a couple weeks off for summer travel. And today we're going to talk about, is transparency the new objectivity? And if we want to change our philosophy as journalists to be more focused on transparency than always being straight down the middle, what sort of niches or coverage areas does that open up that we couldn't do before? And we kind of first got talking about this. Ellen and I talked about this about a month ago. And also when I saw a Time magazine did a poll, and we'll have the link in the show notes. And the question asked is, now that Walter Cronkite has passed on, who is America's most trusted newscaster? And clearly this isn't done just with a random sampling, but still 9,400 people voted, and the overwhelming winner with 44% was Jon Stewart. And, you know, 5 years ago, I think a lot of journalism professors and journalism practitioners would have had heart attacks to see this. And, oh my gosh, those young whippersnappers are ruining our whole country. But I think this is a really telling result, because Jon Stewart is unabashedly opinionated, but you know, very honest in where he's coming from. So why don't we go into Ellen? Just give us a little recap of what are the two sides, and what do you see as the differences and implications for journalists?
Thanks, Dave. Well, you know, transparency and objectivity are two ethical values that journalists have always held very important to the practice of journalism. And with new technologies, you know, there's been a lot of gray areas, you know, between public and private and personal and professional. And with, you know, tools like Facebook and Twitter, you really have the chance to see, you know, people and journalists especially as more than just the person who's reporting the news, but you learn more about, you know, their life. And I kind of compare it to, you know, a DVD, whereas, you know, you buy the DVD to watch, you know, your favorite TV shows, and you see the episodes, but then you also get the deleted scenes and the audio commentary. And so a lot of, you know, the social media and a lot of the blogs and all these tools out there are letting us, you know, provide, you know, DVD seasons of our lives, and not just, you know, the episodes, which would be like the articles that we write. So I think that, you know, whereas some people still hold true that, yes, I need to be an objective journalist, I need to not be tweeting about my life, but just, you know, keep it really professional, share, not have an opinion, not share my opinion. You know, what I tweet is like the sign, the political sign I put up in my yard. Whereas others, they feel like because they are being transparent, that gives them a little bit more leeway in being less objective, so people can see where they're coming from and then make the judgment as to how they interpret what they write.
This is Steve. Just wanted to say that, yeah, Ellen, I really like that DVD analogy, and because when I think about the DVDs that I rent and watch, I very, very seldom watch the extra stuff, or, you know, all the extra deleted scenes and stuff. But if it's a really great, great movie, like the best movie I've seen in months, then I actually will be interested in doing that. And it's probably be the same with news. Most people will just ignore this stuff. But if you really care about an article, or if it's a great investigative piece, people are going to want to find out a little bit more and dig a little bit deeper. And so having that available, I think, is really great.
It's interesting, too, this page. To some extent, to be successful anymore, you need to have, you know, a blog, or you need to tweet, or you need to provide some ongoing dialogue about yourself or your life or your job or whatever. And if you don't, then you're, at least in this industry to some extent, you're sort of abnormal. Does anybody else feel that or see that happening?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's, you know, coming from the educator's perspective as well, that any list I see now of top 10 tips for young journalists or things to do over the summer, the central point is almost even less about doing amazing journalism, but there's so much emphasis on now of building personal brand, which is clearly very important. But, you know, that's, I think, is starting to get drummed into young journalists' head that brand is as important as doing amazing work.
Do you think that's true, though? I mean, do you think personal brand is as important as doing good work?
I don't think so. I'd be interested in what everybody else says. But, I mean, I like, you know, Matt Waite's whole philosophy on that of do stuff or, you know, shut the F up. You can talk as much as you want, and you can write as many awesome blog posts and send out Twitter messages and pump yourself up as much as you want to do. But when it comes down to it is what you say you can do, can you do it? Can you execute? Can you work in teams? Can you deliver a product? And can you get traffic to your product is what it comes down to. So I think that whole transparency and who journalists are can be really, really useful. But, you know, perhaps an overemphasis on journalists personally could be, you know, spending too much time on conveying who you are as a person as opposed to letting your work speak for itself.
This is Steve again. You know, one kind of funny thing is historically it's in the newspaper industry especially, it's been the columnists who really share a lot of their personality. If, you know, you read their columns over months and months and you feel like you get to know them, and it's a bit of a generalization, I realize, but I find that a lot of those people tend to be probably the least transparent in terms of you know, wanting to go beyond the column and wanting to interact with their readers and tweet and all that. It's kind of interesting. And now, you know, now that sort of stuff is spreading out to all the other journalists in an organization.
Well, I think there's a slight difference there because, I mean, most journalists, well, opinion. First of all, I agree with you that I've noticed that many columnists are a lot more reluctant to dive into the transparent world. But as for journalists becoming transparent, just because they're becoming transparent and they're allowing readers to see where they're coming from more, they're not suddenly writing opinion pieces. You know, it's just that, you know, they're still trying to write, you know, regular news articles, but it's just you're getting a more feel for the personality behind them. But I do agree that the work itself should speak for itself. And personalities, like, I guess a reporter putting themselves out there to engage with readers and allow, you know, maybe if a reader has a question to ask or something like that, that's a transparency that I think is definitely worth promoting more. Getting reporters out in tweet ups or having them, you know, communicate via email back and forth more, or Twitter or whatever, so people can, you know, critique, or which I know most journalists don't like, or ask questions or pitch stories more. So, you know, connecting with the person more. But as for building a personal brand, that's something that sounds like it calls for a very egotistical point of view, I guess. I mean, I that is somewhat counterintuitive to what journalists really stand for, I think.
Well, I would just add that, you know, increasingly some traditional reporters are starting to get blogs, and their personality is able to come out more in that format, and they are able to express some opinions more, maybe like an inside city government, or either maybe they're covering the local NFL team, and their reporting and their blog is going to be a little more personal than just the straight news story. So I think maybe there's a little flexibility depending on what type of reporting you're doing, what type of writing you're doing.
And I don't think you have to have a blog or any sort of insight into your personality necessarily to be transparent in your reporting or your coverage. I think just being transparent is letting people know what kind of point of view you have and what might be coloring the product of your work.
Well, it's like the news organization that's been doing it forever, The Economist. Right at the beginning of their magazine, when you open it up, they tell you what their point of view is, and they say, hey, we're writing these articles and this is what we think, but take what you will out of it. And, you know, they they get facts from both sides and write really in-depth articles, and you know that they're arguing for one side, but you can still come out of an article not agreeing with them. You know, I personally can read an Economist article and don't really feel any malintention that they're trying to dupe me either way, but you know, they definitely put out their opinion. So I guess I think that's a decent example of transparency and thorough reporting.
Well, I think something like that, anymore journalists are saying that there's so much information out there that the worth of a journalist is finding you the best of what's available and analyzing it and interpreting it for you and giving you the summary and interpretation of everything that you would have to kind of go through yourself if you had the time. And if you're going to be interpreting and providing analysis, then it is important that people understand what your point of view is. And it's easier, or it's better to at least say right out in front of people, this is the perspective I'm coming from, because otherwise they're going to see through, in all likelihood, they're going to see through to the fact that you are writing from a particular point of view, and they'll probably trust you less because you're trying to hide that. Whereas if you say right up front, like you're saying in The Economist, Stephanie, they're writing from this perspective, I can respect that, and I can still disagree with you, but I trust that what you said is true from your perspective.
There's also another part of this where just because you're stating your point of view and you're writing that, you know, you have to make sure that they are reporting the other side, because you still could not be reporting the other side. You know, there's, just because you're saying you are one thing doesn't mean you're putting forth the whole image. So, but I think that it's a lot easier to debunk or disprove reporting or analysis or something nowadays, because, you know, everything goes out on the internet and there's so much information out there that, I mean, people are just ready and willing to, you know, to put down an idea or, you know, point fingers or call it false. So the necessity for being transparent and thorough is essential. Otherwise, I don't think you can actually make it as a journalist, you know, branded or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think Stephanie, you and Paige bring up a good point. You know, we want to be able to, you know, as journalists, we want our audience to trust us, because if they don't, you know, our credibility is shot. And have any of you used the website NewsTrust at all? I don't know if we've ever talked about it on this show, but it's something. It's a startup out of San Francisco, started by Fabrice Florin, who used to work with a lot of different technology companies, with Adobe and all this stuff. And they created a website called NewsTrust. And what it does is you sign up for the site and you can rate an article and rank its balance, its the transparency, the number of sources it has, and they do these news hunts. So we at Poynter, we did a news hunt with them about, you know, media news articles. And so what people would do, they'd submit these articles about media news, and then not just give them like, oh, this is a great article, I give it 5 stars, but you would say, I give this article 5 stars for its transparency, but there's only a couple sources, so I would only give it 3 stars for that. And it seems like it has a leftist bias to it, so you'd be able to kind of deconstruct an article for, you know, not just, yeah, it's good, but why it's good and why it's good journalism. And I thought that was an interesting approach, because it let, you know, the audience say, you know, this article is, you know, it's biased, or this journalist is biased, because after when an article is put into the system, it also takes a look at that journalist. And you know, if everybody's ranking those articles a certain way, that's going to rub off on the reputation of the journalists on the site. Same with news organization. And I thought that, you know, because a lot of people who do consume journalism, they don't find it by going to the New York Times every day. You know, they'll get it from a direct link from Google News or referred to somebody by somebody else. And so they might not be familiar with either the news organization or the journalist. So I think, you know, how we can help people who are in the audience who are reading the stories, help them to help others understand what is good journalism and, you know, what are the components, what makes something good is another important component.
Hey, Ellen, on News Trust, have they started to, you know, put some of these News Trust ratings on stories kind of out on the web? Because I really haven't seen any, and the only place I see them is on their website and, you know, through the email that I get from them every day. But where it's where that will really be powerful is when those user ratings are actually on an article that I might find through Google News, and then I go to a source and it's one I haven't seen before, and then the trust rating is at the bottom, and I can see that 10 people have rated it, and it'll give me, you know, some good ideas. Do you know anything about that?
Not that I know of. I know that they have like little buttons that you can put on an article saying rated on News Trust. And I know they're working on some sort of widget where it would show up on the site, kind of like the pop-up window for Publish 2, your pop-up window for Delicious, like a bookmarklet kind of thing. But I haven't seen it on any websites. They do have about a dozen different media partners, you know, including like the Huffington Post and New American Media and NewsHour. But I'm not sure if they have done anything to really incorporate it. But Steve, that's a great point. I think that that would really, you know, strengthen it, because right now it's just, you know, available to a limited audience.
The question is, how many journalists do you think would approve or adhere to putting one of these badges on their stories?
Well, why would you think they wouldn't want to?
I don't know. If journalists thought that, you know, people were misperceiving them as biased in one direction or another, or that they would get less readership, or, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a reporter, so I'm just thinking.
If I had articles, I mean, I don't think I have any articles on there, but if I did, I'd be interested to see, you know, how people perceived me and how accurate it was, you know, how... You know, accuracy is another value that's important to us as journalists. So how, you know, what the general consensus is of how they would perceive me, you know, based on the perspective I take in stories or don't take in stories, how that would affect their perception of what I write. I mean, I would be interested in that as a journalist.
It makes me think of Rate My Professor, like a website where you can go and say, oh, this person was, you know, 1 through 5 on different aspects of being straightforward and, you know, being fair and being easy or whatever it might be. And you can go on there and see how people reviewed different professors if you were going to take a class. And, you know, I think the kind of the logic there of Stephanie, of people certainly being hesitant to it at first, but much like with comments, it's pretty easy. People are getting pretty darn savvy at you can fish out a troll relatively quick, so that if you see that overall this person is getting, you know, strong to very strong ratings in specific categories, and somebody is just in there, you know, totally flaming in all ones, and this person's terrible, and, you know, they're racist, yada, yada, yada. I'd see that would get sniffed out pretty quick. And on, like, you know, Rate My Professor, you can, if you're the professor, you can report abuse or say, like, you know, this is unfair, whatever it is, and have it corrected. So I think there's a little bit of a precedent for that sort of thing that could be applied to journalists. And I definitely think people would be, you know, hesitant about it at first, but I think it would sort itself out in the long run, you know, in a transparent way.
Yeah, yep. It's interesting because the users on News Trust, they also get a rating based on, you know, how many articles they've rated, which ones they have the tendency of rating. And so that's just another layer of information too, another layer of context too. This doesn't have to be, I think that News Trust just represents a lot of, you know, a lot of the verification, and a lot of the values that, you know, we as news consumers and the audience also, have to go through when we're trying to judge what is, you know, when a journalist is doing a good job or when an article's fair or balanced and transparent or objective. And so all of these, you know, when we're trying to make these decisions, you know, being able to rely on each other and tools like this to help us in Twitter, you know, I think, you know, you can really cut through and get some more of the truth because of transparency. And I think that's something that is an interesting idea to me.
One other angle on news trust, and I guess it applies to the other stuff as well, is, you know, for my personal blog, I can make the decision about whether I want my news trust ratings to show up on every blog item that I post. But if I'm at the New York Times, well, I'm guessing that decision is probably going to be made at the, you know, top editorial level, and individual reporters are not going to be able to have a say in the matter.
You know, transition from there into bringing up a point that Derek Willis made, couldn't be with us today because he's finishing up a vacation, but an article that I'll link up from the show notes too about transparency is bunk. And this article goes through, and it's more tied toward transparency in government initiatives and starting these programs so you can see all this data, see where money moves, see what people vote from. And the problem there is this perception of transparency can be manipulated relatively easily so that it looks like here's just a data dump, but all those little, you know, piles of money or piles of content, but the context that's happening behind the scene is not obvious out of the data. So that comes into a problem that Derek just wanted to make sure to bring up, even though he wasn't here, is that seeing things as transparent is difficult if we don't have the context of what's going on behind the scenes. And this kind of, my hands are washed clean of this because I provided all of my source documentation, isn't good enough if we're not vetting that source documentation enough.
We don't know what we don't know, basically.
Sure, and it's kind of the same perspective that I take with lots of statistics that are really tough. You know, I've always hated that phrase of statistics lie, and because I think statistics are very clean and data is very clean, but people can misrepresent in a seemingly honest way or in a downright nefarious way, and it can be very transparent in the way that they're applying things, but it's a false transparency because you don't know what's going on behind the scenes, and you just take it as is, and create this false story out of what should have been a transparent document.
Yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting ongoing story that's going to come out of this whole stimulus and the transparency that Obama had written into the actual act. It's, you know, as a journalist trying to follow that story and provide our users coverage, it's still relatively new, but, you know, there's a lot of issues already in terms of reporting and consistency from the different agencies and the ability to compare data from different agencies. So just providing the data is not enough. You know, it's the bare minimum, essentially. And people can say that we were transparent.
But yeah, it's not just providing the data, but it's helping people make sense of it too. It's, you know, it's not just, you know, putting that out there, but it's helping people synthesize it and help them, you know, either guide them to the process of figuring out what the story is, or using the information and as a foundation and providing that information with them for that level of transparency, but also just telling the story, because that's essentially, you know, what we are as journalists is, you know, we're storytellers and so, you know, engaging people in that process is something that a lot of tools and a lot of these innovations let us do. But at the same time, we can't just put data out there and say, okay, I did my job, I'm being transparent, and here's the information, and you can arrive at your own decision and make the story yourself. I mean, we're still, that'd be phoning it in. We still have a role to do as journalists, and we have even more of a role to do just because there is such a wealth of information out there. There's more information than we've ever had before with, you know, the influx of blogs and tweets and, you know, photos, and, you know, people are sharing these nuggets of information that aren't journalists, but they are still doing acts of journalism. And for us, the role of, you know, being a sense maker and helping people make sense of what's coming through the fire hose is something that's, you know, that's changed our role to an extent. So in addition to storytellers, we're also somewhat of sense makers too.
Definitely. I think one of the, and in fact, it does make our role even harder, and it makes, I mean, I think it's essential for journalists to understand all these types of new media and different ways to get information, because there are going to be certain, like you're saying, there are new flows of information that we haven't had to parse through before, and then there are other things that we may not get in, or other types of information that we may not get in the old standards anymore. But one of the points that's on topic with what you're saying is about like this over influx of like data, especially, you know, open government data, public records, et cetera, and so on. What I've gathered, and I don't remember who I was talking to. I don't even remember if it was you, Dave, but we were talking, I was talking with somebody about how there are so many, people out there that, like, you know, programmers and, you know, people who love crunching numbers and, you know, messing with large sets of data that aren't even journalists, who like to pull those things down and just mess with them and build small applications, and like they're not even waiting for journalists anymore to take down that data. You know, the people that are using all the APIs from the UK newspapers like The Guardian or you know, the New York Times, you know, data sets, people just will sit there and play with it. And we need really good, like, statistical analysis, like statisticians and car reporters and data analysis people in newsrooms. It is absolutely essential for the amount of data that we have. But I think it actually kind of draws us back to tradition a little bit. Like, the one thing that the people can't do is make those, you know, like, have those one-on-one connections, those interviews, like, know how to ask the right questions and piece together parts of the story that aren't in writing, or perhaps are in writing in a, you know, in a not so truthful way. The rest of the population aren't the people who are going to do that. It's going to be the journalists. And so it's the journalists, like you're saying, who have to take all the information, maybe take out what you get from the large sets of data, take what you get from the public, and go out and make those interviews and sift through that to create the full story.
You know, that this kind of intersects with the whole newspaper crisis that we've been going through now and all of the layoffs. And, you know, I know of pretty big papers now that might have only one person left on staff after all the layoffs and buyouts, who, you know, really is that kind of data guru, data junkie. So it may be that we just have to think of some alternative ways to get, you know, people outside who are experts in this to help out. And, you know, that's kind of the idea behind beat blogging, where a reporter will, you know, cultivate sources and to help out with stories and sources and stuff. And so, you know, maybe try and bring those other experts in, since we, in many cases, news organizations no longer have that in-house.
Pretty similar concept to what we described, I think, the last episode, where we were talking about mobile apps and perhaps that there could be, you know, like a kind of a collaborative group that different papers or different companies went to be doing cross-platform mobile app development. This same sort of thing could really apply to a lot of the data concerns. So that if you don't have somebody in-house, at least there's, you know, a shop or a small group of people that are kind of the, you know, go-to people for dealing with data from a journalist's perspective, where you can, you know, have some outside help, but still where it'd be relatively quick and affordable and be able to actually do a good job with you know, less resources.
Well, I guess, I think that's really important, and I think we spoke about this a few times ago, yeah, about centralized agencies and everything like that. But I think it's and I do think it's nice to have those people at, you know, at individual newspapers. But my point is that just those car people, you know, as important as they are, they can't do it alone. There's still that need for the traditional interviewing journalism that, you know, we're taught back at university. which is, I mean, because that's what other people can't do. You know, like we get the pass to go in and, you know, we get the numbers to make those phone calls. I don't know. I think it's, I can't think of the word.
Well, yeah. And so, just, you know, and just like what you're saying, you know, there are the people who are charged with going in and interviewing, and then there's the car people that are in charge of, you know, researching and finding all the data. But I think, you know, and yeah, journalists can't do it all, but I think at least being aware of, you know, what it takes to, you know, find a database or complete a FOIA request or do some of the elements, some of the more important elements of a car reporter, especially because they're not in newsrooms anymore. The more versatile you can be as a journalist and the more skills that you have, it's essentially going to show in the stories that you tell and in the quality of work that you produce.
You know, one thing I think we'll start to see pretty soon is a lot of nonprofits that are starting to do some of the really serious journalism and the serious data crunching. And, you know, they won't have the commercial concerns that the newspapers have of just trying to survive. And so they keep cutting back. So recently, I think it was the National Investigative News Network formed, and it's 24 nonprofit investigative news organizations around the country are the charter members of it. And a lot of those, and I know a bit about this because I'm actually working with one of these organizations here in Colorado that we're trying to build at the University of Colorado. And, you know, part of what we'll probably do, and probably the other 23 sites as well, is not only do, you know, original reporting ourselves, but also, you know, go out to, say, a newspaper that just doesn't have the staff to do this data crunching anymore, and then they've got maybe this great story, but they don't have the resources for it. So organizations like these nonprofits may be able to kind of, you know, send in a reporter to help out, or send in a database expert to help out. So might be a little bit of help coming in that way.
I wanted to then move into this kind of this nonprofit, or being, you know, we got to tie in business models every episode somehow. And there's a site, the SCOTUS blog, and it's, you know, probably the, you know, best authority on reporting of the Supreme Court, and kind of the main person in terms of writing is a guy, Lyle Denniston, who just celebrated his 50th year covering the Supreme Court. And so he's worked at a whole bunch of places. I know he worked at the Boston Globe relatively recently. I actually heard him on a panel at the AJMC convention in Boston a couple weeks ago. And the SCOTUS blog is funded by a law firm, but it's a really interesting little concept there, that there's only a couple people and all they do is this specific niche of reporting on the Supreme Court and what's happening in that one specific building. It's funded by a law firm. It says right up in the flag at top that the law firm that it's coming from. And it's a really this interesting juxtaposition that you've got what you'd think would be a very biased news source, but you've got it coming from a guy who has the utmost you know, respect and credential from a really long career of doing this for other news sources. And so it seems to be this place where you actually can get funding from a venue that could be in conflict with the content, but this person is able to keep it objective, and his credibility is basically what makes the content useful. So I thought that would an interesting point I wanted to bring up to see if anybody else had thoughts of going into funding or other niche sources of what transparency would allow us perhaps to do or get funded by that we wouldn't have been able to do traditionally.
Hey, Dave, first, I just have a question about that. Are there some guidelines that they set? For example, can the SCOTUS reporter actually cover cases that his sponsoring law firm is involved in, or are those kind of off limits for him? You know, are there some rules like that?
As far as I know from what he said on this panel is that he can cover stories that the law firm is involved with, but on those specific articles, it appears, I think at the very top of the article, that the law firm that does this site is involved with this. And that he, and obviously because he has the career to back it up, he can be total, he just does his thing. And from what he was saying, that whether his firm, this firm is involved or not, makes no impact on the way he does his work. And that's the agreement that he has with the people who fund this, is that there's zero influence from the firm on what they write or what they don't write. And so they kind of leave him alone, even if he says something that perhaps is in contention with the law firm's position.
They have a 5 out of 5 rating on NewsTrust for transparency.
I think that's a good thing. So, yeah, I was really inspired when I heard this, when I heard him talking on this panel. And it's, you know, very small group. I think there's maybe 5 or 6 people total involved with this blog. So that's clearly, it's not something like, oh, some big newspaper is going to transition into this sort of model. But I found it very interesting of covering an area that was being neglected because of shrinking newsrooms and budgets, covering it with a very small team in a funding from a very non-traditional way. But as you just did a quick fact check there, Paige, that, you know, if people still can see these two conflicting things of objectivity versus being funded by a law firm and find they can reconcile that this is still good, trustworthy information.
Dave, I've got a question actually for all of you on this. I have been thinking about this a lot because of this work I'm doing with the University of Colorado. And, you know, one thing that comes up if you're trying to set up, say, a nonprofit investigative reporting entity is, let's say that I'm lucky enough to find some local philanthropist here in Colorado who wants to give us $500,000, but wants to do it anonymously. You know, do we are we totally pure and turn that down? Oh no, we would have to, you know, say who you are to be totally transparent, or do we take the $500,000? I'm just curious what thoughts you all might have on that.
Wow, I don't know where to go with that, except for I guess it would really depend on the topic and whether the topic you're doing, it's, you know, let's say that it's an anonymous, but the person's funding, you know, they're like an athletic booster or something, and so they're funding a blog about sports. Well, then I could kind of see, well, they don't want it to be known that they're funding it. Okay, maybe that would be doable. But if it was something on, you know, somebody gives you $500,000 and it's totally about, you know, local government, and it's somebody who's a major land developer or something like that in your local area, then that would certainly be the place where I would start to get really queasy and have to think really long and hard about how that would actually work.
Yeah. You know, one other thing that keeps coming up in our discussions is, you know, In this case, you know, trying to build basically a state watchdog, state investigative journalism thing, and it's, you know, it's a totally good, wonderful thing. But trying to, you know, find people or foundations to want to donate to the startup costs, it's sometimes a little hard to get people excited about the idea of the death of investigative journalism or you know, the what's happening to watchdog journalism. People outside of the media industry doesn't necessarily resonate with them. So sometimes you kind of have to say, focus on what they really care about. And if it's a philanthropist who cares a lot about the environment, you know, one of the things I guess you got to talk about is, well, you know, can we take that person's money and just don't put it in a pile that only covers environmental stories? And then maybe set some guidelines to it, such as, that are published, such as the donor or the sponsor for this environmental coverage, you know, has a strict wall between the money philanthropy side and the editorial side.
I mean, that to me sounds exactly like how science is funded. You know, people donate money for specific research initiatives, and that's just the way funding works from, you know, federal government as well, that whatever the president or people in specific positions feel is of the most pressing research agenda, that's what gets funded. And so I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, so that if somebody gave all this money, but their shtick or their real interest is they're really concerned about the watchdog or investigative stuff in a specific topic area, like environmental or city government or whatever it might be, I don't see a problem there of earmarking that money that's only to be done for the investigative real hard stuff in that specific area, as long as it's not influenced what's being done in that area. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think it's one thing to, it's still the ethical process, minimizing the harm or, taking a look at what the risks are and, also acting independently no matter what you decide. That's a great alternative. In those kind of situations, you just have to think about, what are the options here? What could we do and which one's going to be the best fit for, our university, our organization. And then when you do that, you're really thinking through, the decision and not just making it. And then you can explain that process, so then you can be even more transparent with your audience. So you can say, this is the decision we made. And this is how we came to it.
Yeah, great point, Ellen. And I think perhaps a topic we should look at in the next couple weeks is trying to get a conversation going with somebody from one of these nonprofit institutions or somebody who's donating money for a specific area. I think that'd be a really interesting conversation to talk about of how that process works and what sort of stuff can be funded and won't be funded and other issues involved there. And thank you everybody on Twitter who sent some messages my way on your thoughts on objectivity and transparency. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.